she regarded as the future of fashion. And she said, well, you know, you don't have to work that way. And that was really the first time I had ever even given it a minute's thought.
Hi, I'm Sebastian Bolney, and this is The Sustainable Fashion Wingman, the podcast exploring the brands, innovations, careers, making fashion more environmentally and ethically friendly, proving that fashion doesn't have to cost the earth, literally. I hope you're enjoying listening to the podcast and are following along. Why not invite your friends to listen too? There's a lot of episodes coming your way throughout the year. And if you'd like to connect to like-minded professionals in responsible and sustainable fashion, why not connect with me over on LinkedIn? And if you're interested in careers in purpose-driven fashion, you can always follow our James Byron Talent LinkedIn page. Now, hailed by Condé Nast as London's only sustainable fashion destination boutique, Pop London has made leaps and bounds over a short time, from wholesale beginnings to selling sustainable fashion online and retail. Today, I'm pleased to have the co-founder and managing director of Pop, Shazia Salim, to talk with us about its sustainable journey in e-commerce and retail, and what sustainability truly means to the business. So where did Pop all start? And what's it like to start a retail business as a sustainably focused brand? Well, let's find out. Hi, Shazia. Great to catch up with you again. How are you?
I'm really well. Thank you, Sebastian. Thanks for inviting me onto the podcast.
You're welcome. It's good to talk to you again. Really pleased to have taken time out to chat with us today and to tell us the interesting story of Pop London, and of course to get your take on sustainability as both an online and retail boutique label. Before we jump into the topic of Pop, of course, let's try and get a little bit of background on yourself. How did you actually get into fashion?
Well, formally, I got into fashion after having quite a conventional undergrad and postgrad education. So of course, with so many people in fashion, the love and the imagination starts from childhood, and I'm no different in that respect. But you know, I did quite conventional business and accounting and marketing degrees. And then as a mature student, I moved to Italy, to Florence, and that's when I really started my formal shift into fashion. Following Florence, I moved to London. I actually grew up in Scotland. And of course, in the UK, you know, I just felt that I need to be based in the fashion capital. And not only is it the UK's fashion capital, but it's the world fashion capital. So of course, you know, London's where it's at. And I'm really pleased with that decision. And I haven't really looked back since.
So you've covered quite a journey yourself in your own personal, quite a distance, should I say, in your own personal journey. What were you doing in, what kind of work were you doing in fashion originally?
Yeah, so when I mean, my career in fashion in London started as a really humble intern at a luxury, a household name, a luxury brand. And I had just such a dream experience. I mean, I had the worst of being an intern with making coffee and taking the mail to the post office. But at the same time, I had, because of my maturity and because of my ability, I was offered a job actually really quickly into the internship. So I was really lucky in that respect. And then from then on, it turned into a real Devil Wears Prada type of experience. It was such a whirlwind 2 years. I had the most amazing time at the London Fashion Week seasons, seeing how the designer brought the collections together, you know, being there when when these really high profile directors for the catwalk show were putting all the looks together. Then I got to travel to the designer to the Ritz in Paris, and we stayed there. I was in the buying team, and so, you know, I mean I didn't speak to them, but I saw Anna Wintour and Andrew Leon Talley, who sadly passed away recently. But you know, it was just so glamorous and glitzy, and I had it was a wonderful start, and it had none of the cattiness that's traditionally associated with the fashion industry. So So I was really, I was really fortunate in my beginnings in the fashion industry, but I sort of always knew that I wanted to start my own thing, but you know, I couldn't have asked for a better beginning.
It sounds like an amazing kind of introduction to the industry and quite a high level luxury kind of area as well. And of course, internships are a great place to start when you want a career in fashion itself. So what made you kind of, you know, go from that and working in the business and being quite hands-on to kind of jumping the career ship and now doing your own thing? What motivates you to do that?
Up until I started studying fashion, up until I moved to Italy, I was only a consumer of fashion, whether that's of the product or the imagery and consuming the fantasy and all that marketing. And it was only when I moved to Italy that one of the tutors there started drawing our attention to how unethical the industry was and some of the practices that happen in it, and how we as the next generation of designers, as we, you know, because we were still in college and where the, we were, she regarded us as the future of fashion. And she said, well, you know, you don't have to work that way. And that was really the first time I had ever even given it a minute's thought of, oh, how do clothes actually reach shops and what actually happens behind the scenes. And, you know, so, I mean, that was way back in the early noughties. And I mean, you can sign up to do a degree now in specializing in sustainable fashion and ethics, and you can do modules in them. But actually, when I was at fashion college, you had to just do your own research. There wasn't a structured educational environment or any literature. You know, it really was a case of like roll your sleeves up. And I was doing my fashion work and doing the internship in the day, and then spending my own time outside of that doing the research into exploring some of the peeling behind the velvet curtain, and you know, figuring out what was happening. So that was really when the seed was planted. And then I always knew that I wanted to start my own business. I always knew that. And so when I, there was a slight overlap between my employment and starting, starting down an entrepreneurial road. And so, and I just thought, well, since it's sometimes harder to retrofit sustainable practices. So I thought, well, why not just do it from the beginning? You know, then why not just put it into the very foundations and the very DNA of what I'm about, since those issues are important to me. So that was really why I sort of went down that way initially.
So sustainability is obviously really important to your business from the beginning.
Yes, absolutely.
And you're right. It's great to see that a lot of courses today, like you said, not so much in the past or a few years ago even, but today especially, a lot of the courses in universities are now teaching sustainability as part of their fashion courses. It's very rare that I come across a graduate who doesn't say, oh, actually, yes, I'm doing a module on sustainable fashion in my course, or I wrote a dissertation around innovations in sustainability. So it's brilliant that we're actually seeing that being ingrained into education from the start, and that, you know, the next generation of workers are all going to have this kind of education and knowledge coming with them, which is what we need. So now I know you were doing, sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, it's just so important as well for us to have generally accepted terminology and vocabulary to describe what's going on, you know, and to even, and this is the wonderful thing about social media as well, where it has democratized communication, you know, where someone who's working in a factory on the other side of the world actually can just, you know, expose some of the things that are happening. And when a factory collapses in another side of the world, actually, and if the mainstream news doesn't cover it, that actually you can expose it and you can come together and articulate the problems and the solutions. So yeah, I think it's wonderful that it's more commonplace. These conversations are more common now.
So previously you were working, you were wholesaling your own kind of designer or brand before you started Pop. So what made you, you know, how did Pop suddenly, well, pop up on the scene with a store? What made you go from wholesaling a product to actually creating Pop and creating Pop in the terms of a store?
Well, I'll try and condense it as much as I can. But up until 2017, I had only ever wholesaled in fashion. So, you know, the unfortunate thing about fashion is that it is an industry. It has set calendars. It has set seasons. And as a new designer, as a independent brand, you want, what wholesaling opens up is the possibility to have your collection stocked in other people's beautiful boutiques up and down the country. And actually you can, so you, for your brands and for your exposure, you're in multiple stores at one time. And I've never sold on concession. So when a boutique buyer buys into your collection, they're actually investing in you as a designer. They believe in you, believe in your designs. And it's a real confidence builder. And it's of course great for cash flow. And yeah, it's a really positive way to start a brand and to get that, you know, to go from a concept in your head to actual physical product and to go through the learning process of dealing with factories and dealing with the production side of the industry, because it's not simple and straightforward. You do need to go through the process to be able to understand it. And so, but the thing is, having a sustainable brand and working in ways that is more difficult, because you're not working in a conventional way where I just place an order with fabric wholesalers, and I'm, you know, it's not as straightforward as just ordering thousands of meters of fabric and telling, you know, giving an order to a factory and then supplying that. When the way that I work is more complicated, and I can go into it a bit later, but I was basically shoehorning a business that was more thoughtful and slower to manufacture into a fashion industry sales cycle of, you know, wholesale, which didn't allow for that actually. But in order for me to begin, I needed to, I'm only one person, right? And it's a new brand. So I have to follow what the industry is doing. I can't create my own cycle and expect buyers to change the way that they buy and the way that they do business. So, but the thing is though, actually I worked that way very successfully and I probably could have continued, but I have to say I did find the pressure quite overwhelming. And so in 2017, I took a break. I left London. I moved back to Edinburgh for a couple of years just to recuperate, just to figure out what it is in sustainable fashion, what it is that I'm doing, what I'm doing that's different, where my strengths are, how I can operate in a fashion industry that's not really set up for the way that I was working. And because I've always been really responsible and reliable, so I've never let the wholesale buyers down. I've never let a boutique down. So because of building those relationships, and I was so terrified of leaving, because you think, oh well, out of sight, out of mind, and I'm just a small brand. If you're not continuously creating for next season, then you'll just be replaced by another brand, you know? So there's a lot of pressure to just keep going. But because of the relationships I'd built, the buyers all said to me, it's fine, you know, when you're ready, come back to us. We've got, you know, we'll be there with you when you're ready. And so that was amazing. It was, you know, to have those conversations, and you know, it was reassuring as well. And it made me feel that, okay, I can take this time out. But what then happened in that time is that I felt that Well, I had another quite fortunate thing happen to me where one of my friends was run. She had a boutique in Edinburgh, a sustainable, ethical, sustainable fashion boutique, and so I spent about 18 months just helping her out, just working with her and going to this, you know, helping her open the boutique and running it, and it was the first time. It was the first time as a designer that I got to see the end customer, the actual retail customer's reaction to my collection. So when you're wholesaling, yes, you're designing a collection for an end retail customer, but my customer was a wholesale buyer. My customer was a boutique buyer. So I was always reliant on them giving me feedback for what customers, how customers felt, how they reacted, how they interacted with my designs. And so actually you are designing blind to an extent. You get feedback from buyers, but it is filtered, and you don't necessarily always get answers to your questions. And so having this time in Edinburgh, which, you know, I mean, I love Edinburgh, but it's not exactly known for fashion. It's not known for, you know, being out there with, you know, with their style. And the fact that my designs were selling really well, the fact that I was interacting with the end customer and she loved it, and everything that I had said that the brand was about, I mean, customers were just articulating that back to me, how they felt, how much they loved the fabrics, how much they loved the way that they felt. And, you know, actually, it was just so eye-opening, and it was really thrilling. I mean, it's addictive, you know, to be in that environment. I mean, I wouldn't compare myself to an artist, but I am a creative, and to go from an abstract customer to hear the real customer understanding you and understanding your designs. I mean, you know, it just gave me a lot of confidence. And so when I recuperated, I moved back to London, and then I spent some time before that, you know, creating the concept for Pop. And the shift, I was really lucky that the boutique became available at the same time as I launched. So that was just complete luck. But what I felt the difference with doing wholesale, and why I wanted Pop to be more focused on retail, is that actually, and maybe this is something you've come across as well, Sebastian, but you know, when you're wholesaling, you are really dependent on the buyer placing the order, and actually they might go for the more sensible pieces. They're going for pieces that are more commercial, which quite rightly they've got bills to pay, they need to pay their rent, they need to pay salaries, and so they're going to tend not to go for the bolder pieces. They're going to tend not to go for the edgier designs. They're going to tend to go for shirts, black trousers, black skirts, you know, and, you know, which the more conservative pieces. But my experience working with my friends showed me that actually my customers, they'll go for whatever I design, actually, you know, and I can be myself, and I can have confidence in my designs, and that what the wilder styles, actually customers will buy them, they will come, and they and I don't need to be more conservative, and I don't need to inhibit my creativity. And you know, with Pop, then, you know, I've got my tagline that it's sustainable fashion for people who love fashion, and that really is just to capture that feeling and everything I experience with having a direct connection to customers.
Yeah, there's a lot of information around how you've gone into retail, and it is really interesting, because let's just go for like the back end of what you just said there, of course, is that you are connecting with your customers, which is what in retail allows you to do. Yes. And then looking back again a little bit more into what you said, you're right, there's these pros and cons of working in, well, both retail and wholesale. But on the wholesale side, you are working through the requirements and the needs of a third party.
Exactly.
At the end of the day, you're wholesaling into their retail department, their brand or their business, and you're having to give what their customers want. But their customers might not necessarily be your customers.
Yes.
And of course, doing retail allows you, as a creative person like you are, it allows you to be much more creative, and you're not having to then design to the demands of a brand or a business that just might not be your style or not, might not be the customer that you want to go for anyway. And I imagine your customers are much more pleased to have this kind of variety of creativity that they come to you for in the first place, rather than being restricted by whatever the other retailer that you're wholesaling into has placed upon your,
yes,
your process.
Yeah, because it's people's interpretation, isn't it? And, you know, an independent retailer, you know, they've got an idea of what they're about and who their customers are. And yeah, it's just luck if they all align. And it's just wonderful. It's just wonderful to, it is great to have them, but it's wonderful to have my own as well. And it's just in terms of just even pure market research, you know, for anyone out there who's thinking about designing, you know, doing their own, starting their own brand as well, it's irreplaceable. The knowledge, the experience, the interaction, the live feedback, the thrill, I do recommend it. It's wonderful.
I think it's good that you went from wholesale to retail, because it sounds like when you were wholesaling, it did teach you a lot of things about, what, you know, a little bit about commerciality and what actually you can get away with almost,
yes,
you know.
Yes.
So I guess that did help in itself as well. And you're right, for anyone that's starting a business, I think it's really important to kind of bear in mind that even though, you know, you can be commercial and you can work with wholesalers, there are a lot of demands on the product. There are a lot of demands on your business. And even though retail can be a little bit trickier, even if it's e-commerce and it's your own outlet, there are benefits to it as well.
Yes.
And I think on a sustainability point of view too, I know a lot of brands that I've spoken to have said that selling wholesale makes it trickier almost to be sustainable, depending, of course, where you wholesale into, but usually because the numbers have to be bigger.
Yes.
There's often large demands on quantity and price. So you've got to bear that in mind when starting a business and thinking about wholesale.
Absolutely. And, you know, when I was younger and inexperienced in fashion, when I was wholesaling, I would get these wonderful orders, but actually, you know, I was working with weavers who were hand weaving. And so I hadn't a clue that actually they were going to take months to weave the fabric. And then my delivery deadlines were just going to give me a nervous breakdown, you know, but it's an experience to go through. And I lived and learned from the experience, but I don't have those issues now with Pop. But, you know, there are definitely pros and cons and to both of those. And I really appreciate that I had the experience with both.
Oh, yes. Lead times. We've got to consider lead times too.
Yes.
So you've gone into retail with Pop now and you want to be more sustainable. That's obviously at the forefront of the business. What do people expect when they're coming into Pop? What are they going to look at? What can they buy? How is it set up?
I was really determined from the outset that even though Pop is sustainable and ethically made, and it runs through the very core of the entire supply chain, the value chain, and, you know, it could be described as circular, but I almost describe it as pre-circular, because actually all of that concept of repair, rewear, reuse, that goes into, even as I'm drawing the designs, you know, I'm already considering all of those processes and each stage from creating the concept to selecting the fabrics. You know, they're all sourced from their upcycle, their dead stock. And then when we go into production, we're looking at eliminating the waste, we're reusing, reworking the fabrics in, you know, and then considering buttons and threads and things like that. So all of those processes are considered in the entire production process from design to finish. But at the same time, I was absolutely determined that Pop would not look like a sustainable fashion brand. And that is because sustainable fashion is not considered fashionable, and ultimately a customer is only going to buy your designs based on how the product looks, if it meets their need, if they feel amazing, if there's a design value, if they feel that's their style, that they can wear it with ease and stuff, you know. So it has to speak to them on a design level first and foremost. And the thing about sustainability at Pop is that actually I'm doing it in spite of customer curiosity. No one's looking, and no one, you know, I would say not no one, but I think most people don't really care about the sustainability, or it's too much to think about that. But actually we're doing it in spite of all that. I don't believe that there's enough of a demand for those aspects that are really dear to me. Actually, they are dear to me as a person, and I don't really feel that it's necessary to moralize or lecture others. So actually, when you come into Pop, it's a really contemporary space. It's laid out, even though the pricing is affordable, it's sort of regular high street prices from about £39 to about under 200. That's the pricing spectrum. So it is just high street prices. But when you come into the boutique, it's really well lit. It looks, you're having a more premium experience. The rails are nicely spaced out and merchandised. And it's really important for me to give, you know, they're fresh flowers, and there's a really lovely ambience. And it's really important for me to give sustainable fashion customers a really premium boutique experience, because they don't really get that anywhere apart from, say, for example, like a Stella McCartney level brands, you know. I know Reformation's opened in Covent Garden, but you know, it's very rare to get, you know, to come into a sustainable fashion boutique and be pampered, and to get that feeling that actually we care about what you're wearing. And that's the general vibe here. But it's a friendly boutique. Boutiques normally, people get quite intimidated by them. So I try to make it as welcoming as possible as well. You know, it's important.
It does sound like the customer experience is important to you, very much so. And of course, keeping the price point at a level that is more affordable than the usual, what people often say, you know, overpriced sustainable product, which we try to emphasize as much as we can on this podcast, that that's not necessarily always the case. And that's therefore not necessarily an excuse to not buy sustainably. So it's nice to hear that there's a high street boutique where you can just pop in and really enjoy the sustainable fashion experience without feeling pressured or out of pocket.
Yes.
One of the interesting aspects about Pop that I was looking into is obviously the fabrics that you use. And obviously you don't kind of just produce huge quantities of garments. You're obviously keeping the runs very low and very small, because they're based on fabrics that have been reused or rescued.
Yes.
And heritage fabrics such as Khadi. Now, just for anyone who's not familiar with Khadi, can you tell us a bit about what that is and how you came to use that in your collections?
Yes. So it is very true that every single style that I design, that I produce, is from reclaimed and upcycled and deadstock fabrics. Khadi is a fabric that I've been working with for over a decade. When I first started my own brand, it was a luxury premium brand focusing on hand-woven textiles. So it was all hand-woven silks and tweeds, and Khadi was, I first came across Khadi, I did all my own research. I went to India. I'm of South Asian background, but I'm not Indian origin. And so I didn't have any friends or family there to sort of guide me through. It was literally, you know, and this was way back when there were no smartphones, only dumb phones. So, you know, I literally had to sit on a desktop computer in London and do a bit of research and write people's names and contact details down. And I went to Delhi. I based myself there, but I traveled around the country, just did a lot a lot of research on weavers and hand weaving and the different specialisms in India. Khadi itself, khadi, it means almost literally, it's about hand spun. Khadi is like a hand spun, mostly referred to as cotton hand spun, but it also includes silk or wool and linen as well. You get hand spun linen as well. So of course, India is, you know, has ancient heritage in weaving. So the concept of khadi as such is not new. Hand weaving has happened around the world for millennia, but the khadi movement of hand spun and hand woven gains prominence during India's struggle to gain independence from British rule. India used to be a colony of the British Empire, and the India that I'm referring to, of course, includes Pakistan and Bangladesh. India was a lot bigger, and then it was partitioned first into West and East Pakistan, with India in the middle, and then East Pakistan became Bangladesh. You know, so Gandhi, you know, Mahatma Gandhi, Mohandas Gandhi, he was one of the most prominent freedom fighters for Indian independence from British rule. And he was the one who really made it more high profile that actually to join the independence movement, that the Indians started spinning and weaving their own cloth, their own fabric. And post-independence, it wasn't the reason, but it was like a big part of the Indian independence movement, along with many other steps and political steps. So post-Indian independence, khadi is still a really important part of those three countries in terms of a handcraft movement and support, because, you know, these countries have huge amounts of wealth, but they're like real polar extremes, with lots of weavers living in abject poverty and, you know, having their craft, you know, is undervalued or not valued. So, you know, it still retains that political ideology, but more in terms of supporting weavers and supporting livelihoods nowadays, and appreciating craft and handcraft rather than, you know, the independence movement now. But I've been working with it for a very long time, and it's wonderful to have such a, you know, to be only like one step removed from someone who actually produced the fabric.
So that's where you get it from. You're getting it from actual artisans in India and area. Wow, it's amazing. And so they're still developing it as a way to kind of support the communities within the countries.
Yes, exactly.
That's brilliant. And also not quite as old a history, although quite an old history, is obviously Harris Tweed as well, which comes from part of our Great Britain here, which is Scotland.
Yes.
And I know that you use that, but it's again one of those fabrics which has a heritage to it, has history to it, and not often a fabric that is seen in other kind of brands, because you have to be licensed to actually use it. So how did you manage to get that into your collections?
Yeah, so the same time that I was working with weavers in India, I had mentioned Scotland before and that I grew up there. So I knew of Harris Tweed, of course, you know, I mean, all Scottish people know of it. And I knew that it was handwoven as well. And so I just contacted the Harris Tweed Authority. I contacted a couple of mills and things and just said, well, you know, look, I'm Scottish, and I'm working with all these amazing weavers in India, and can we work together? And luckily for me, they sponsored me. They sponsored me twice to make collections. And, you know, the second time was to help celebrate the centenary of the orb. So like you just mentioned, Sebastian, that you need to be sort of almost licensed to use it. You need permission to use it. And it's the only fabric in Britain that's protected by an act of parliament. It's most famous for menswear, for tweed jackets. The most famous influencer of Harris Tweed is James Bond and Coco Chanel. They were really, the Yuna Chanel was really fond of Harris Tweed. And I've been really fortunate that, you know, I was invited to the Hebrides to meet the weavers and to see how I have a more emotional connection to it because I've been there as well, and I've designed with it and work with it. But you really get to see how the flora and fauna and the landscape inspires the wool, how it inspires the color combinations. And I got to see how the wool fibers are brought together, and, you know, in what the process is from you know, collecting the wool to the spinning and the dyes and all of that Acacia weaving. I mean, so yeah, it's an absolutely wonderful part of our collective heritage in the UK as well. And again, you know, it is and it isn't valued. So Harris Tweed has to be hand woven, but it's just all these crafts that, you know, they become unaffordable for most people. And so because they don't affect most people, they become forgotten and undervalued. But actually, you know, fabric is a part of, you know, textiles are a part of our heritage. So I still incorporate Harris Tweed into the bags in Pop because I'm more about affordability. You know, to create blazers and outerwear from Harris Tweed would mean that they would retail for several hundred pounds, and whereas I can make bags with Harris Tweed and upcycled leather for a much more affordable price range, and still get to support the weavers and the mills. So that's how I interpreted how I can continue to work with it.
That's such an interesting kind of understanding of the way that you've come to find these fabrics. And it's obviously quite a personal connection with you've got quite a cross-continental connection yourself. And it sounds like your fabrics and your the way that you're producing the products also have that as well. Not just one collection of fabrics and that's it, but like a variety of fabrics with history too, which, yes, I'm sure is very interesting for your customers.
Yeah, again, I'm from a minority ethnic background in the UK. So from the South Asian heritage of my background, you know, hand-woven saris and hand-woven brocades are, you know, we've had them in my family since our grandparents and great-grandparents, you know, sort of preciously stored weavers. Their skills were really valued in my family, and they were handed down in wedding trousseaus from grandparents to their children. And you know, as a child, I was never really allowed to touch the silk brocades and things, you know, and I could only look at them. But, you know, when I first went to India to try and find weavers, then, you know, I took these stories from my mom and my grandparents, and, you know, I went to research the areas in India that they were woven in. And, you know, that was really eye-opening. And, you know, the world's a big place, and there's so many talented weavers and artisans. But, you know, being, you know, someone of a South Asian heritage, transplanted in, you know, in Scotland, then I'm going back to India to work with heritage craft. And then I go back to Scotland, and actually the weavers in the Hebrides are using the same type of, they're using the same type of looms. They need the same type of parts. They've got the same type of personalities, you know, with their eccentric elements. And I'm not going to make this. No, I'm, you know, those whims that creatives have. And, you know, it's wonderful to see how much we have in common, how much history we have in common. And it's really important to articulate and let people, you know, to share the stories and to, you know, I feel my role as a designer is to, you know, often, you know, craft people and weavers, they're not good at selling their wares. And so how I interpret their creations in my own and bring it to a different customer is, you know, I think it's important. I think we're an important part of that process.
It is important, and it's also very fascinating as well, and something that is unique to small businesses like yourself as well. Now, not a lot of small businesses actually have retail stores. A lot of the businesses we talk to are generally e-commerce, you know, small businesses and startups. Do you think it's much more challenging to do retail for sustainable brands?
I don't think it's more challenging. What I feel is that perhaps it's more challenging to have e-commerce. I feel because before the pandemic, the sort of sales of Pop were 80% in the boutique and 20% online. And during the pandemic, of course, that switched rather dramatically. And now it's more 50-50. And what I feel is that both have positives and negatives, just much like we were discussing about wholesale and retail. So the wonderful thing about having boutique is that, you know, I'm part of a community here. Like the customers that come here, you know, the regular customers, the new people who discover the brands, you know, there's something really special about them being able to touch the fabrics and try things on and have that immediate satisfaction of taking clothing away with them. And then, you know, as a business person, there's a cost of running the boutique. But, you know, the positives of being online is that you can, you know, I've built this amazing community online, but of course, not everyone lives in London and I've got customers from outside. And so the website enables me to reach those customers. But there are costs. It's not running an online business isn't, I feel, in my opinion, it's not as democratic as it would appear to be, because you do need to invest a lot for little return in terms of online marketing and things, you know. And while you build that up, I mean, I'm sure in the long term, you can, you know, the investment you make in online ads and things like that would pay off. But I feel it's almost more prohibitive and to sell online. And because I'm producing in small quantity, you know, that whole customer, I'm quite lucky that I don't really get, you know, with at Pop, we don't really get that many customer returns because we are quite good with our communication and, you know, sizing and things. But just producing in small quantity means that actually your stock could be locked up in different parts, you know, and so there's with a sustainable brands, I think you just have to invest in both, and because they complement one another. But I'm really, really happy that I have a retail arm of the business and an actual physical bricks and mortar presence.
Yeah, I think it's good to have both. And obviously, with retail, I guess you don't have to do things like, or you probably cut down a lot more on things like returns, which is good for logistics and obviously carbon footprint. So, just before we go, I just wanted to ask, what is the future of Pop? Will we see maybe a retail expansion in the future?
I would love that. So the future of Pop is expansion, and, you know, certainly in key parts of the UK, you know, I'm hoping internationally as well. Being sustainable means there are complications because I can't produce to the quantity as such, but they're very, I would say, relatively straightforward creative solutions to all of these issues and things, you know. So I do feel that Pop is really different, that we're really meeting a need in the market. I do feel that the experience that I've had with my current customers, you know, is, I there's so much potential, and I'm hoping it can only get bigger and better in a controlled way, not growing too fast as well. But I'm definitely looking forward to expanding and growing the business.
Well, it sounds like you've created that, or you've discovered that demand and customer loyalty by the experience of your first store, which obviously is now going to allow you to expand with the knowledge of knowing that it's something that people do want.
Yes.
Well, Shazia, it's been lovely to talk with you again today and to find out more about the sustainable boutique Pop and your journey to retail. For listeners, why not check out the Pop story further and the collections, or even pop into the boutique? The address can be found on the Pop website, which the website link can be found in the episode description. Thank you again for listening. This has been the Sustainable Fashion Wingman podcast, and I'm Sebastian, helping you dress, live, and work more sustainably.